The audible of the best in Bitcoin. This is the Cryptoconomy.
What is up, everybody? I hope you had a wonderful weekend, and I hope you got to hear Dear Family, Dear Friends by Gigi, which we read on Friday. It was an excellent piece, particularly a great one to share out with people that you know that are just dipping their toes or just cursory interested in Bitcoin and really haven't taken that next step, that first step down the rabbit hole, really. A really good one to share out. Quick thank you to our sponsor, Swan Bitcoin, for making the simplest place to stack sats every week, every paycheck, every month, and start a Bitcoin savings plan that you can just set and forget. And I even have my own URL now, swanbitcoin.com/guy, G-U-Y. So if you want to let them know that I sent you, don't forget the /guy. Now, if anybody was staying up to date on articles and the Unchained Capital blog, then it's obvious what I'm going to be reading today. Parker Lewis has just released the next piece in the Gradually Then Suddenly series, and it requires no other introduction. This is from the Unchained Capital blog, and it is Parker Lewis's Bitcoin is Common Sense. Quote, "Perhaps the sentiments contained in the following pages are not yet sufficiently fashionable to procure them general favor. A long habit of not thinking a wrong thing gives it a superficial appearance of being right, and raises at first a formidable outcry in defense of custom. But the tumult soon subsides. Time makes more converts than reason." Thomas Paine, Common Sense, February 24th, 1776. These were the opening remarks of Thomas Paine's call for American independence in early 1776. At the time, a declaration of independence was far from a certainty, but in Paine's view, there was no question. It wasn't a debate. There was only one path forward. Still, he understood that public opinion had not yet caught up and naturally remained anchored to the status quo, with a preference for reconciliation rather than independence. Old habits die hard. The status quo has a tendency of being defended, regardless of merit, merely by its anchoring in time to the way things have always been. However, truths have a way of becoming self-evident in time, more often due to common sense rather than any amount of reason or logic. One day, the truth is more likely to smack you in the face, becoming painfully obvious through some first-hand experience which opens up a perspective that otherwise would not have existed. While Paine was undoubtedly attempting to persuade an undecided populace with reason and logic, it was at the same time an appeal to not overthink that which stands in opposition to what is already self-evident. In Paine's view, independence was not a modern-day IQ test, nor was its relevance confined to the American colonies. Instead, it was a common-sense test, and its interest was universal to the cause of all mankind, as Paine put it. In many ways, the same is true of Bitcoin. It is not an IQ test. Instead, Bitcoin is common sense, and its implications are near universal. Few people have ever stopped to question or understand the function of money. It facilitates practically every transaction anyone has ever made, yet no one really knows the why of that equation, nor the properties that allow money to effectively coordinate economic activity. Its function is taken for granted, and as a result, it is a subject not widely taught or explored. Yet despite a limited baseline of knowledge, there is often a visceral reaction to the very idea of Bitcoin as money. The default position is predictably no. Bitcoin is an anathema to all notions of existing custom. On the surface, it is entirely inconsistent with what folks know money to be. For most, money is just money because it always has been. In general, for any individual, the construction of money is anchored in time, and it is very naturally not questioned. But enter Bitcoin, and everyone suddenly becomes an expert in what is and isn't money. And to the fly-by-night expert, it certainly is not Bitcoin. Bitcoin is natively digital. It is not tied to a government or central bank. It is volatile and perceived to be slow. It is not used in mass to facilitate commerce, and it is not inflationary. This is one of those rare instances when a thing does not walk like a duck or quack like a duck, but it's actually a duck. And what you thought was a duck all along was mistakenly something entirely different. When it comes to modern money, the long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it a superficial appearance of being right. In all perceived to be successful applications today, Bitcoin is issued by a central bank. It is relatively stable and capable of near infinite transaction throughput. It facilitates day-to-day commerce, and by the grace of God, its supply can be rapidly inflated to meet the needs of an ever-changing economy. Bitcoin has none of these traits. Some not presently, others not ever. And as a result, it is most often dismissed as not meeting the standards of modern-day money. This is where overthinking a problem can cripple the highest of IQs. Pattern recognition fails because the game fundamentally changed, but the players do not yet realize it. It is akin to getting lost in the weeds or failing to see the forest through the trees. Bitcoin is finitely scarce. It is highly divisible, and it is capable of being sent over a communications channel, and on a permissionless basis. There will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. Rocket scientists and the most revered investors of our time could look at this equation relative to other applications in the market and be confounded, not seeing its value. While at the same time, if posed with a very simple question, would you rather be paid either in a currency with a fixed supply that cannot be manipulated, or in a currency that is subject to persistent, systemic, and significant debasement? An overwhelming majority of individuals would choose the former all day, every day. On Bitcoin, quote, "It's probably rat poison squared," Warren Buffett. Quote, "Bitcoin, there's even less you can do with it. I'd rather have bananas. I can eat bananas," Mark Cuban. Money doesn't grow on trees. As kids, we all learned that money doesn't grow on trees. But on a societal level, or as a country, any remnant of common sense seems to have left the building. Just in the last 2 months, central banks in the United States, Europe, and Japan, the Fed, ECB, and Bank of Japan, have collectively inflated the supply of their respective currencies by $3.3 trillion in aggregate, an increase of over 20% in just 8 weeks. The Fed alone has accounted for the majority, minting $2.5 trillion and increasing the base money supply by over 60%. And it's far from over. Trillions more will be created. It's not a possibility, it is a certainty. Common sense is that deep feeling of uncertainty many are experiencing that says, this doesn't make any sense, or this doesn't end well. Few carry that thought process out to its logical conclusion, often being it is uncomfortable to think about. But it is reverberating throughout the country and the world. While not everyone is connecting the equation to 21 million Bitcoin, a growing number of people are. Time makes more converts than reason. Individuals don't have to understand how or why there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. All that has to be recognized in practical experience is that dollars are going to be worth significantly less in the future, and then the idea of having a currency with a fixed supply begins to make sense. Understanding how it is possible that Bitcoin has a fixed supply comes after making this initial connection. But even still, no one needs to understand the how to understand that it is valuable. It is the light bulb turning on. Quote, "If people can print money, they will print money." Michael Goldstein, at Bitstein on Twitter. For each individual, there is a choice to either exist in a world in which someone gets to produce new units of money for free, but just not them, or a world where no one gets to do that, including them. From an individual perspective, there is not a marginal difference in those two worlds. It is night and day, and anyone conscious of the decision very intuitively opts for the latter, recognizing that the former is neither sustainable nor to his or her advantage. Imagine there were 100 individuals in an economy, each with different skills. All have determined to use a common form of money to facilitate trade in exchange for goods and services produced by others, with the one exception that a single individual has a superpower to print money, requiring no investment of time and practically at no cost. Given human time is an inherently scarce resource, and that it is a required input in the production of any good or service demanded in trade, such a scenario would mean that one person would get to purchase the output of all the others for free. Why would anyone agree to such an arrangement? That the individual is an enterprise, and more specifically a central bank, expected to act in the public interest, does not change the fundamental operation. If it does not make sense on a micro level, it does not magically transform into a different fundamental fact merely because there are greater degrees of separation. If no individual would bestow that power in another, neither would a conscious decision be made to bestow it in a central bank. Everything beyond this fundamental reality strays into abstract theory, relying on leaps of faith, hypotheticals, and big words that no one understands, all while divorced from individual decision points. It is not that one individual is more trusted than another, or one central bank relative to another. It is simply that, on an individual level, no individual is advantaged by someone else having the ability to print money, regardless of identity or interests. That this is true leaves only one alternative, that each individual would be advantaged by ensuring that no other individual or entity has this power. The Fed may have the ability to create dollars at zero cost, but money still doesn't grow on trees. It is more likely that a particular form of money is not actually money than it is that money miraculously started growing on trees. And at an individual level, everyone is incentivized to ensure that it is not the case. While there is a long habit of not thinking this particular thing wrong, the errant defense of custom can only stray so far. Time converts everyone back into reality. At present, it is the Fed's shock and awe campaign contrasted by the simplicity in Bitcoin's fixed supply of 21 million. There is no amount of reason that can replace an observed divergence in two distinct paths. Defending existing custom. Quote, "There's money and there's credit. The only thing that matters is spending, and you can spend money and you can spend credit. And when credit goes down, you better put money into the system so that you can have the same level of spending. That's what they did through the financial system, referencing QE in response to the past crisis. And that thing worked." End quote. Ray Dalio, CNBC, September 19th, 2017. Basic Bitcoin Common Sense. There is no such thing as a free lunch. As more people become aware of the Fed's activities, it only begins to raise more questions. 25000000000000 is a big number. But what is actually happening? Who gets the money? What will the effects be and when? What are the consequences? Why is this even possible? How does it make any sense? All very valid questions, but none of these questions change the fact that many more dollars exist, and that each dollar will be worth materially less in the future.
That is intuitive. However, at an even more fundamental level, recognize that the operation of printing money or creating digital dollars does nothing to generate economic activity. To really simplify it, imagine a printing press just running on a loop. Or imagine keying in an amount of dollars on a computer, which is technically all that the Fed does when it creates, quote, money. That very operation can definitionally do nothing to produce anything of value in the real world. Instead, that action can only induce an individual to take some other action. Recognize that any tangible good or service produced is produced by some individual. Human time is the input. Capital production is the output. Whether it is software applications, manufacturing equipment, a service, or an end consumer good, all along the value chain, an individual contributed time to produce some good or service. That time and value is ultimately what money tracks and prices. Entering a large number into a computer does not produce software, hardware, cars, or homes. People produce those things, and money coordinates the preferences of all individuals within an economy, compensating value to varying degrees of time spent. When the Fed creates $2.5 trillion in a matter of weeks, it is consolidating the power to price and value human time. It seems cryptic, but it is not a suggestion that the individuals at the Fed are consciously or deliberately operating maliciously. It is just the root-level consequence of the Fed's actions, even if well-intentioned. Again, the Fed's operation, arbitrarily adding zeros to various bank account balances, cannot actually generate economic activity. All it can do is determine how to allocate new dollars. By doing so, it is advantaging some individual, enterprise, or segment of the economy over another. In allocating new dollars that it creates, it is replacing a market function, one priced by billions of people, with a centralized function, greatly influencing the balance of power as to who controls the monetary capital that coordinates economic activity. Think about the distribution of money as the balance of control over influencing and ultimately determining what gets built, by whom, and at what price. At the moment of creation, there exists more money, but there exists no more human time or goods and services as a consequence of that action. Similarly, over time, the Fed's actions do not create more jobs. There are just more dollars to distribute across the labor force, but with a different distribution of those holding the currency. The Fed can print money, technically create digital dollars, but it cannot print time, nor can it do anything but artificially manipulate the allocation of resources within an economy. Since 2007, the Fed balance sheet has increased sevenfold, but the labor force has only increased 6%. There are roughly the same number of people contributing output, human time, but far more dollars to compensate for that time. Do not be confused by impossible-to-quantify theory concerning the idea of a job saved versus a job lost. This is the U.S. labor force, defined by the Bureau of Labor Statistics as all persons 16 years of age and older, both employed and unemployed. The inevitable result is that the value of each dollar declines, but it does not create more workers, and all prices do not adjust ratably to the increase in the money supply, including the price of labor. In a theoretical world, if the Fed were to distribute money in equal proportion to each individual that held the currency previously, it would not shift the balance of power. But in practical application, the distribution of ownership shifts dramatically, heavily favoring the holders of financial assets, which is what the Fed buys in the process of creating new dollars, as well as those with cheap access to credit, the government, large corporations, high net worth individuals, etc. In aggregate, the purchasing power of every dollar declines, just not immediately, while a small subset benefits at the cost of the whole. See the Cantillon effect. Despite the consequences, the Fed takes these actions in an attempt to support a credit system that would otherwise collapse without the supply of new dollars. In the Fed's economy, the credit system is the price-setting mechanism, as the amount of dollar-denominated debt far outstrips the supply of dollars, which is also why the purchasing power of each dollar does not immediately respond to the increase in the money supply. He posts a couple of graphs here, but I want to go over one just to illustrate his point here about how the credit system is the pricing mechanism. So the entire system debt, all other U.S. debt that is non-federal, is at $56.4 trillion, whereas the federal government debt is $19.1 trillion. The economy is attempting to contract that debt because the actual number of system dollars is $4.5 trillion, and this is after the additional $2.4 trillion has been added in the last few weeks. So each dollar is still levered 17 to 1, despite an increase in system dollars of $2.4 trillion, or an additional 100% of supply, essentially a doubling of the number of real dollars in the system. I encourage you to go to the actual article, which I'll have the links in the show notes, so you can actually get a visual idea of what he's trying to illustrate. There are a number of other charts that we have skipped over and will do so later on in the article. Instead, the effects of increasing the money supply are transmitted over time through an expansion of the credit system. The credit system, attempting to contract, is the market and the individuals within an economy adjusting and repricing value. The Fed, attempting to reverse that natural course by flooding the market with dollars, is, by definition, overriding the market's price-setting function, fundamentally altering the structure of the economy. The market solution to the problem is to reduce debt, an expression of preference, and the Fed's solution is to increase the supply of dollars such that existing debt levels can be sustained. The goal is to stabilize the credit system such that it can then expand, and it is a redux to the 2008 financial crisis, which provides a historical roadmap. In the immediate aftermath of the prior crisis, the Fed created $1.3 trillion new dollars in a matter of months. Despite this, the dollar initially strengthened as deflationary pressures in the credit system overwhelmed the increase in the money supply. But then as the credit system began to expand, the dollar's purchasing power resumed its gradual decline. At present, the cause and effect of the Fed's monetary stimulus is principally transmitted through the credit system. It was the case in the years following the 2008 crisis, and it will hold true this time, so long as the credit system remains intact. Here again, we have three charts demonstrating these ideas from a couple of different data points, and I highly recommend going to the Unchained Capital blog and visiting this article so you can get a better visual representation of what he's talking about. How the effects manifest in the real economy is very complicated, but it does not take any sophistication to recognize the general direction of the endgame or its foundational flaws. More dollars result in each dollar becoming worth less, and the value of any good naturally trends toward its cost to produce. The marginal cost for the Fed to produce a dollar is zero. With all the bailouts from both the Fed and Congress, whether to individuals or companies, someone is paying for everything. It is axiomatic that printing money or creating digital dollars does nothing to generate economic activity. It only shifts the balance of powers as to who allocates the money and prices risk. It strips power from the people and centralizes it to the government. It also fundamentally impairs the economy's ability to function as it distorts prices everywhere. But most importantly, it puts the stability of the underlying currency at risk, which is the cost that everyone collectively pays. The Fed may be able to create dollars for free, and the Treasury may be able to borrow at near zero interest rates as a direct result. But there is still no such thing as a free lunch. Someone still has to do the work. And all printing money does is shift who has the dollars to coordinate and price that work. Quote, "The emitting of paper money by the authority of government is wisely prohibited by the individual states, by the national constitution, and the spirit of that prohibition ought not be disregarded by the government of the United States. Though paper emissions, under a general authority, might have some advantages not applicable, and be free from some disadvantages which are applicable to the like emissions by the states separately, yet they are of a nature so liable to abuse, and it may even be affirmed so certain of being abused, that the wisdom of the government will be shown in never trusting itself with the use of so seducing and dangerous an expedient. In times of tranquility, it might have no ill consequences. It might even be managed in a way to be productive of good. But in great and trying emergencies, there is almost a moral certainty of its becoming mischievous. The stamping of paper is an operation so much easier than the laying of taxes that a government, in the practice of paper emissions, would rarely fail in any such emergency to indulge itself too far in the employment of that resource, to avoid as much as possible one less auspicious to present popularity. If it should not even be carried so far to be rendered an absolute bubble, it would at least be likely to extend to a degree which would occasion an inflated and artificial state of things, incompatible with the regular and prosperous course of the political economy." Alexander Hamilton, The Writings, 590-591.
"Gospodin," he said presently, "you used an odd word earlier. Odd to me, I mean." "Oh, tanstarf. Means there ain't no such thing as a free lunch, and isn't," I added, pointing to a free lunch sign across the room, "or these drinks would cost half as much." Was reminding her that anything free costs twice as much in the long run, or turns out worthless.
"An interesting philosophy."
"Not philosophy. Fact. One way or other, what you get, you pay for."
The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, by Robert Heinlein. Bitcoin is common sense. Among its perceived flaws as a currency, Bitcoin is viewed by many to be too complicated to ever achieve widespread adoption. In reality, the dollar is complicated. Bitcoin is not. It becomes very simple when abstracted to the least common denominator, 21 million Bitcoin. And who controls the money supply? No one. Not the Fed or anyone else. At the end of the day, that is all that matters. Bitcoin is, in fact, complicated at a technical level. It involves higher-level mathematics and cryptography, and it relies on a mining process that makes very little sense on the surface. There are blocks, nodes, keys, elliptic curves, digital signatures, difficulty adjustments, hashes, nonces, Merkle trees, addresses, and more. But with all this, Bitcoin is very simple. If the supply of Bitcoin remains fixed at 21 million, more people will demand it and its purchasing power will increase. There is nothing about the complexity underneath the hood that will prevent adoption. Most participants in the dollar economy, even the most sophisticated, have no practical understanding of the dollar system at a technical level. Not only is the dollar system far more complex than Bitcoin, it is far less transparent. Similar degrees of complexity and many of the same primitives that exist in Bitcoin underlie an iPhone. Yet individuals manage to successfully use the application without understanding how it actually works at a technical level. The same is true of Bitcoin. The innovation in Bitcoin is that it achieved finite digital scarcity, while being easy to divide and transfer. 21 million Bitcoin ever. Period. That compared to 2.5 trillion new dollars created in 2 months by one central bank is the only common sense application anyone really needs to know. Exhibit A, Dollar Supply. A chart of the Fed's balance sheet during QE1, QE2, QE3, and now potentially QE infinity. Plus Exhibit B, the Bitcoin supply. A chart showing the progressive decline in new Bitcoin supply. Equals Exhibit C, purchasing power of Bitcoin relative to dollars. And a chart from 2012 to 2020 showing the progressive increase in the purchasing power of Bitcoin. There is a lot happening in the background, but these three charts are what drives everything. People all over the world are connecting these dots. The Fed is creating trillions of dollars at the same time the rate of issuance in Bitcoin is about to be cut in half. See the Bitcoin halving. While most may not be aware of these two divergent paths, a greater number are. Knowledge distributes with time, and even a small number of people figuring it out ultimately puts a significant imbalance between the demand for Bitcoin and its supply. When this happens, the value of Bitcoin goes up. It is that simple, and that is what draws everyone else in. Price. Price is what communicates information. All those otherwise not paying attention react to price signals. The underlying demand is ultimately dictated by fundamentals, even if speculation exists. But the majority do not need to understand those fundamentals to recognize that the market is sending a signal. Once that signal is communicated, then it becomes clear that Bitcoin is easy. Download an app, link a bank account, buy Bitcoin. Get a piece of hardware. Hardware generates address. Send money to address. No one can take it from you and no one can print more. In that moment, Bitcoin becomes far more intuitive. It seems complicated from the periphery, but it is that easy, and anyone with common sense and something to lose will figure it out. The benefit is so great and money is such a basic necessity that the bar on a relative basis only gets lower and lower in time. Self-preservation is the only motivation necessary, and ultimately breaks down any barriers that otherwise exist. The stable foundation that underpins everything is a fixed supply which cannot be forged, capable of being secured without any counterparty risk, and resistant to censorship and seizure. With that bedrock, it does not require a lot of imagination to see how Bitcoin evolves from a volatile novelty into a stable economic juggernaut. A hard-capped monetary supply versus endless debasement. A currency that becomes exponentially more expensive to produce compared to a currency whose cost to produce is anchored forever at zero by its very nature. At the end of the day, a currency whose supply, and derivatively its price system, cannot be manipulated. Fundamental demand for Bitcoin begins and ends at this singular cross-section. One by one, people wake up and recognize that a bill of goods has been sold, always by some faraway expert and never reconciling with day-to-day economic reality. With Bitcoin as a backdrop, it becomes self-evident that there is no advantage either in ceding the power to print money or in allowing a central bank to allocate resources within an economy. and in the stead of the people themselves that make up that economy. As each domino falls, Bitcoin adoption grows. As a function of that adoption, Bitcoin will transition from volatile, clunky, and novel to stable, seamless, and ubiquitous. But the entire transition will be dictated by value, and value is derived from the foundation that there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoin. It is impossible to predict exactly how Bitcoin will evolve, because most of the minds that will contribute to that future are not yet even thinking about Bitcoin. As Bitcoin captures more mind share, its capabilities will expand exponentially beyond the span of resources that currently exist. But those resources will come at the direct expense of the legacy system. It is ultimately a competition between two monetary systems and the paths that could not be more divergent. Bananas grow on trees. Money does not. And Bitcoin is the force that reawakens everyone to the reality that was always the case. Similarly, there is no such thing as a free lunch. Everything is being paid for by someone. When governments and central banks can no longer create money out of thin air, it will become crystal clear that backdoor monetary inflation was always just a ruse to allocate resources for which no one was actually willing to be taxed. In common sense, there is no question. There may be debate, but Bitcoin is the inevitable path forward. Time makes more converts than reason. Quote,
"You can fool all the people some of the time, and some of the people all the time, but you cannot fool all the people all the time."
Abraham Lincoln.
Quote, "These proceedings may at first seem strange and difficult, but like all other steps which we have already passed over, will in a little time become familiar and agreeable. And until an independence is declared, the continent will feel itself like a man who continues putting off some unpleasant business from day to day, yet knows it must be done, hates to set about it, wishes it over, and is continually haunted with the thoughts of its necessity."
Thomas Paine, Common Sense. Let's take a quick break and hit our sponsor, and then I want to take a little bit of time to talk about this piece. The BitBox O2 hardware wallet is Bitcoin ownership. Too many people make the mistake of thinking that because they bought Bitcoin on an exchange or other service and they show them a balance, that they own that Bitcoin. But not really. It's an IOU. The only way you know you own Bitcoin is by holding your own keys. Only then do you know your account can't be frozen like on Robinhood, or that your funds can't be stolen by a bail-in like in Cyprus, or that you can't move it unless it's a business day or have some other arbitrary withdrawal limit like at the bank. When it's on your BitBox, it's yours, and no one can do anything to change that. You know, Obama said that using Bitcoin is like having a Swiss bank account in your pocket. Using the BitBox is like having a Swiss bank vault in your pocket. It's secure, open source, actually Swiss made, and easy to use. The best way to hold the world's most secure digital asset is in a secure digital vault, the BitBox O2. Check them out at guyswan.com/bitbox.
I was very happy to find out that the previous article was not, in fact, the end of the Gradually Then Suddenly series, that was my original thought. But Parker does a wonderful job of dropping another bomb on the unavoidable reality of our times. Bitcoin is common sense. When put like this, the way this is broken down is so great. It just hitting the fundamental. And this is what I talk about all the time, is that
like talking about repo and trying to like explain that, oh, this is debt and these are the exact stipulations in which it can be created and all this stuff completely obscures the most fundamental element. And in this, as he puts it, that it is common sense that there is no advantage. There is no reason for an individual to choose to use a money that they have to work their butts off for, that they have to spend enormous amounts of labor and time in order to acquire voluntarily, when anyone else, it doesn't matter who or why or for what reason or for whatever their intention is, if someone else can produce it for virtually zero cost, it makes no sense. The fundamental reality of that relationship is that one person has to produce for all of the things in the world, and the other person gets to allocate and take resources from everyone else and does nothing at all, does not contribute 1 ounce of productive activity or value to the entire economy, but can take everyone else's resources. That is what it means, plain and simple. No convoluted mess, no 10,000 stacks of, 6 degrees of separation and confusion and all of this terminology and all of these economic models, or does it create jobs or does it save jobs? All that bullshit. The underlying reality is that one person gets to take and move resources in the economy without ever having produced or actually putting skin in the game to participate in the actual process of exchange. It is theft, no matter which way you flip it or what color you paint it. And the allusions and the quotes from, it makes me want to go back and read Common Sense. I doubt I've ever actually read that. Even though obviously I know of the piece, but God, it's amazing the analogy that Thomas Paine used of just like the simple fact, like, this is going to be, disagreeable. Most people aren't going to have yet come to terms with this, but there's a simple statement of fact, like, there is no other solution here. The only, like, it is independence. We must break from this money. There's no other fix. And all we are doing are delaying the inevitable. Time will make more converts than reason, because the simple truth of the matter is common sense. And it doesn't take any elaborate explanations. It takes the simple demonstration of these two obviously divergent paths, and that one makes sense and the other is just nonsense. Now, I love how he kind of starts this off on the basic thing everybody has heard and everybody knows, that money doesn't grow on trees. And it's funny, I've used this often in the past, specifically to illustrate this point and the importance of it. And I think it also illustrates something very important about what money is. As in why money has certain characteristics and why it's literally impossible for something to be money if it grows on trees. The sort of simple analogy I like to use is, even if money grew on trees, even if you literally could plant a seed with a tree and it spit out a whole bunch of money that was all the leaves, let's say all the leaves were $100 bills, even if they looked exactly like they do today, we would still call them leaves, and we would still rake them up into piles and either throw them away or set them on fire, because they would be absolutely worth nothing. Genuinely, they would be a nuisance, exactly the same as leaves are today. Just fundamentally, think about the idea of trading something. It means that you want equal value of that thing. So if it takes you 2 hours to make a thing, and it's very difficult to make that thing, why on earth would you ever trade it for something that could be made instantly for no cost and no time whatsoever? What do you intend to get back out of that ever could equal the value of something that took hours of your time and potentially skills that took years to acquire. The whole point of economic exchange is to take your 2 hours doing thing A, which you can do better or that match your skills, and trade it for that thing of equal skill and roughly equal time of someone else so that both of you can have both of those goods. The price of a good, the price of a money that costs nothing at all to produce, is going to be zero sooner or later. That is the only end to it. Another great section that I hadn't, the excerpt or whatever, which is a screenshot from Alexander Hamilton, like the writings of Alexander Hamilton, about how essentially it is wisely prohibited by the states and the Constitution that the government not be allowed to have to create any paper emissions of money. It is absolutely known, regardless of any short-term potential benefit or the fact that even during a time of, you know, peace and where everything is working, that maybe even you could argue that there is some benefit to it or that it has some potential advantage, which I think is kind of fundamentally an error. Like how could that possibly be? But irrelevant. Let's say that that's possible, but that no matter what, there is, in fact, let me just find this because I love this quote. That because the free from disadvantages, yet they are of a nature so liable to abuse, and it may even be affirmed so certain of being abused, that the wisdom of the government will be shown in never trusting itself with the use of so seducing and dangerous and expedient. And I had a tweet just the other day, or I guess it was like late last night sometime, about like, you know, money is a foundational tool of society. It is that which we think of as the most secure place to put those crucial hours of our life where we produce something, of storing the output of those skills that we spent so much time learning and perfecting, that we would put it in the most secure thing, the thing that has the least expansion of its supply, in order to best store that value for the future, because there is no point in doing a thing if we get no benefit from it. It is a waste of time. It is a waste of our lives. And to have a money that someone else produces at will is to throw and store your wealth in it for any length of time, is to throw away all that you are doing with your life. It's to just let someone else confiscate it without any consideration whatsoever. And to think that someone, a politician, a government, any institution, any individual, wouldn't use the ability to print money, to take resources for free, that would somehow just be that their intent and their, you know, honesty would be so just and so powerful and so persistent forever into the future, regardless of who and how many people changed hands in this institution, that it would never be used, is fundamentally a rejection of human nature. It is the equivalent of putting your head in the sand and refusing to admit an uncomfortable truth. It is truly the most seducing and dangerous expedient that we could allow any central power to have. Okay, so there's a handful of things I saved from this piece, which I just think really apply right now to what's going on, is that particularly in the realm of inflation or deflation in the dollar, and the credit system itself, how well it can be propped up, how long we can expect before like inflation starts, we start to see inflation. And what's funny with like helicopter money, you know, essentially the proposals of essentially UBI, I think is going to happen at a far, far faster pace. And if you actually look at the charts, it's been happening at a faster pace since 2008. And that's actually the consumer price index, which is way off what I would consider legitimate measuring of inflation in the economy. I much prefer, and which shows far more specifically the inflation that's actually going on, the Chapwood Index, which you can get at chapwoodindex.com. Let me write down a note so I don't forget to add that link. That is a major one that is basically crowdsourced, I guess you could say. It's like 500 different items over like I think it's like 50 of the top cities, and they're just tracked over time just by literally going to these stores and checking them out in the major cities, like what are the prices of them on average, aggregating all of that information, and then, you know, giving an average. And most cities have 10% a year inflation, 12%. Like, these are not uncommon, even as high as 20% over the year. It's the rural areas and a lot of the tricks of the accounting system that they make it, they really subdue this apparent inflation and really twist the consumer price index to make it appear as if this is not happening. The quote I want to hit real quick is that, like, so this is during the 2008 crisis that he's talking about, is that despite the fact that at the time they printed like 1.5 trillion new supply into the system, while obviously the same thing that's happening now happened then, a drastic pressure in attempting to deleverage the credit system because it was unsustainable, they had to just dump trillions of dollars into the actual banking system in order to match reserves and to prop up the fact that all of this debt could not actually be paid for. So, quote, despite this, the dollar initially strengthened as deflationary pressures in the credit system overwhelmed the increase in the money supply. But then, as the credit system began to expand, the dollar's purchasing power resumed its gradual decline. At present, the cause and effect of the Fed's monetary stimulus is principally transmitted through the credit system. It was the case in the years following the 2008 crisis, and it will hold true this time, so long as the credit system remains intact. So this is basically what we're facing this time, is a potentially a heavy acceleration. I think it's pretty much natural that these things have to compound on themselves, that whatever degree of inflation we had previously from 2008 to 2018, we should see an exaggerated case of this this round, and particularly since we are so much more leveraged yet again than we were previously, which was true last time yet again, this will happen to a far greater effect. And the fact that we have this flood of unemployment at the same time because of this huge lockdown and coronavirus and all of this mess, we're going to get, like, we're already getting helicopter money. They're just pumping out money into the economy to try to prop up all of the debt that's there and that has been unsustainable for damn near three decades. And because of that, that money is going to flood quickly into all sorts of things. And I think it's already been a reason for upward pressure on the Bitcoin price from our recent crash, because it's so quick. Like, I think we'll see it happen in Bitcoin quicker than we will see other goods and services, specifically because Bitcoin is so liquid. It's so quick to actually get into it, and its price will adjust. And because of that, it's becoming more scarce. We're about to go through a halving. So while the gap between the capital coming in and the capital coming out that difference between that thing is the price adjustment. So if there's, like, you know, we could have $1 trillion in volume, but if there's only $100 price, $100 more going in than going out, if it's like, you know, $500 billion and 100, and the other one is, you know, $499.99999, whatever, then the price doesn't move very much, right? The only important number is the difference between those two things. So if dollars are literally being printed out and just distributed into the economy, and there's a whole subsection of people who now have extra money, because inevitably there's a whole lot of people who aren't unemployed and whose costs didn't really increase, maybe even have decreased. There's a lot that, Like, particularly my costs have decreased because I'm not making all these travel plans and going out and doing things. Like, we're actually keeping more money than we were previously because we've still been relatively stable. There's been, you know, some scares and everything, but miraculously, we've come through this pretty all right. But because of that, we have, like, we're able to put this directly into Bitcoin. This is immediate upward price pressure on Bitcoin. And the gap that is needed to push that price up is about to get cut in half. Meaning if the same amount of capital, even if the number of the dollars in the system aren't being increased, if the same amount of capital is moving into Bitcoin, it will necessarily have to rise unless a greater amount of capital also starts leaving the system. And just like Parker says in this piece, is that you don't have to understand all the intricacies of the system to get the price signal. That was such a great way of putting that. That the whole point of this is that, like, the reason the market has a price is to communicate information, because there is too much information out there for everyone to figure out. The price is going to be that which tells the market that this is scarce against the goods it is being compared to, against the dollar. And just like, you know, our behaviors change and our choices in the economy change when, you know, there's a massive earthquake in China and suddenly their consumption of concrete, you know, goes 3x. Well, the price of concrete here skyrockets and we necessarily halt our behaviors. We change our choices. We decide, okay, well, I was going to put on, you know, a new patio outside, concrete patio, or make this new, you know, construction project, or this, that, or the other, going to use this. I was going to redo my driveway, you know, whatever it is. But because the price of concrete just skyrocketed, I'm not going to do it right now. I'm going to hold that off. And we don't have to know. The beauty of the price system is that we don't have to know what happened. We don't have to, you know, be watching the news, the Chinese news, to know exactly how much concrete is needed and how many people are doing projects and exactly the destruction caused by the earthquake. We don't have to know anything. All we need is the price signal to tell us that we should change our behavior or that we should produce more concrete if we're concrete producers. And in that exact same way, we don't have to understand how Bitcoin works. We don't have to know all the ins and outs. We don't have to understand the monetary philosophy, because if it remains true that Bitcoin is scarce, that Bitcoin is 21 million and no more, the price is going to tell us to get it. And it is going to signal that reality as time passes. This is why people call this an inevitability, that hyper-Bitcoinization is simply something that happens as given enough time. Given enough time and the fact that Bitcoin stays as scarce and secure as it is now, that it survives. That's what it has to do. And that's it. In fact, I got a quote here, I think, that is along these lines. Here it is. So again, this is from the article. There is a lot happening in the background, but these charts are what drives everything. And he's talking about the charts of the Bitcoin supply, the money supply from the Fed, and then the Fed balance sheet, and, you know, showing the increases during the different quantitative easing periods that we've had. And I can't remember exactly what the third chart. The third chart was just the price of Bitcoin over time, just showing the exponential curve increase of the Bitcoin price. So these three charts are what drives everything. People all over the world are connecting these dots. The Fed is creating trillions of dollars. At the same time, the rate of issuance in Bitcoin is about to be cut in half. See the Bitcoin halving. While most may not be aware of these two divergent paths, a growing number are. Knowledge distributes with time. And even a small number of people figuring it out ultimately puts a significant imbalance between the demand for Bitcoin and its supply. When this happens, the value of Bitcoin goes up. It is that simple, And that is what drives everyone else in. Price. Price is what communicates information. All those otherwise not paying attention react to price signals. The underlying demand is ultimately dictated by fundamentals, even if speculation exists. But the majority do not need to understand these fundamentals to recognize that the market is sending a signal. End quote. Such a good way to just simply illustrate that is the speculation doesn't matter. It's all froth on the underlying fundamentals, that the more even a intransigent minority, a small group of participants do understand the fundamentals, they will be the price signal that signals to all the others who do not have to be paying attention, but to see that there is a clear fundamental here, that there is something fundamentally of value and fundamentally important that is going to continue to drive up this price. It is an entirely inescapable, impossible to ignore signal that says, hey, look at me, pay attention to this. And remember this, the thing that it's illustrating, the ultimate truth that Bitcoin is forcing us to come to terms with is the fact that our money is broken and it is not at all serving or advantageous in any way to the individual anymore. It is advantageous to the wealthy, to the elite, to the political class, and to governments wanting to confiscate and control resources. That is who it benefits, and it benefits nobody else. One of my favorite quotes from this whole thing is one sentence, and it says, "Self-preservation is the only motivation necessary, and ultimately breaks down any barriers that exist otherwise." And that's about the idea that doesn't matter how complicated the supposed wallet is, which he talks about it like after you see the price signal, after you're paying attention to it and you begin to realize what's actually happening and that the importance of Bitcoin or the critical fundamental element of Bitcoin, regardless of the cryptography, the game theory, the incentives, no matter how it actually achieves this, is totally irrelevant and unimportant. If it is true, and we realize that Bitcoin is 21 million, period, end of story, then the rest of Bitcoin is pretty damn simple. Go to an exchange and, you know, set up your account, connect your bank account, and buy Bitcoin. Click on buy Bitcoin just like you buy a stock. Hell, it might even be the same platform that you bought your stock on. Or it's a stupid, simple, straightforward process like something on Swan Bitcoin or Cash App or whatever it is you're using. You just go up there, you click on the Bitcoin tab or start your Bitcoin savings plan. You just put an amount and you say go. And then to hold it yourself, you make a wallet. It generates an address automatically. You just hit the receive button and then you punch it, you send Bitcoin to it. That is literally the level of understanding that anybody really needs. And the self-preservation, the price signal that will bring, that will continuously steal mind share from the legacy system that will begin to pull the people in who are going to direct and figure out all the new ways to develop and steer this thing into the future to make it useful in 1,000 other ways. Just like the internet, they are going to make it simple enough that eventually people don't have to know any of it. That they just kind of get used to the interface, kind of get used to some basic, you know, computer literacy, and then it works. Like, we just get associated to these technologies. And when they are that fundamental to society, when they enable something so much greater than what is able to, than what is possible today, it's just a matter of time. It's just a matter of time. All of those perceived barriers break down under the simple motivation of self-preservation. Guys, just such a good quote. Another one. Let's do another one real quick before we close this out. The stable foundation that underpins everything is a fixed supply which cannot be forged, capable of being secured without any counterparty risk, and resistant to censorship and seizure. With that bedrock, it does not require a lot of imagination to see how Bitcoin evolves from a volatile novelty into a stable economic juggernaut. Amen, Parker Lewis. Do not forget to check out the Unchained Capital blog. We're going to leave this here. Lots of great charts with that and numerous links actually as well in that article to go exploring. Highly recommend it. Click the link in the show notes. And of course, a huge loving thank you to swanbitcoin.com for supporting this podcast, the Audible of the Bitcoin space, bringing this content to you so that you get to hear 2 days after it's released, you get to hear Gradually Then Suddenly series in your ears while you're, you know, running your errands or doing your dishes, whatever it is. SwanBitcoin.com are the Bitcoiners making that possible. So when you go to SwanBitcoin.com, you can either click the link in the show notes or just go to SwanBitcoin.com/guy, G-U-Y. Got my own URL now. Super happy about it. Do not forget that /guy on the end when you start your Bitcoin savings plan. All right, guys, I'm out. Thank you so much for listening. I will catch you tomorrow with another episode of the Audible of the Bitcoin space. Until then, take it easy, guys.